Triumph Herald. My new car was an upgrade and at the time considered quite stylish. A gunmetal blue 1966 Triumph Herald 1250. I envisaged a 1200cc engine and the 50 was the mighty 50 horsepower it produced. It had a wooden dashboard, blue vinyl seats with white piping, a sliding vinyl sunroof, two doors, white rubber bumpers, and a pair of fins at the back like a mini Cadillac. Did it have a radio? I really can't remember. But the well-secured and comfortable seats, a bonnet that fitted, and two bumpers did seem some kind of progress. I've since discovered it was fitted with front disc brakes, which I had forgotten, but I do remember it having a very tight turn-in circle, which allowed you to do U-turns in one go in a normal road width, like a London cab, but without the obligatory non-stop opinionated commentary. Despite my pride owning this marvel of British engineering, I only seem to possess three photos of it. I recall it boasted a fair amount of chrome that needed cleaning and was light inside because of the large windows. Also that the front bonnet and wings all swung forward in one piece to give good access to the engine, which could sometimes be attended to while sitting on one of the front tyres. This seemed a benefit in those days of home mechanical repairs. I can remember cleaning out the carburetor, changing the plugs and filters, and at one MOT test I was informed the trunnion bushes needed replacing. First of all, I was unaware I possessed trunnion bushes and was ignorant of what they were and what they were for. I think the repair wasn't too expensive and it hasn't happened in any other car, so I hope it's not a sky-hooked-up scam for garages. Now it sounds like something Heston Blumenthal would include in one of his recipes. The car did have one fault, which was an irritatingly loud vibration noise which would emanate from the gear lever. I found that if I held the gear lever and steered with one hand, it reduced the noise considerably. But on longer journeys, such as the trip down the M4 from Kent to Wales, I would tension the lever by hooking a rubber elasticated gungee and attach the other end underneath the driver's seat. This required rapid release at the toll services on the Severn Bridge, but satisfactorily suppressed the noise. Happily back in Folkestone, the son of a neighbour who also owned a Triumph explained he had solved the problem with a set of replacement bearings. These were available from Triumph Spares. He also told me, which I already suspected, that the gungee treatment was only aggravating the problem. One evening he helped me dismantle a gear lever and we solved the problem, at least temporarily. I think that for the next couple of years I repeated the repair. There was either something wrong with the gear stick or the way I was changing gear. I have a vague memory of this suspicion being confirmed when a particularly aggressive gear change on the hill out of Dover left me holding the gear stick, which had separated from the rest of the car. The lesson from this is that reassembly needs as much attention as disassembly, maybe even more. Around this time, I was to experience one of what I call my toe-to-toe haul moments. In the book The Wind in the Willows, Toad is rendered speechless when he witnessed a speeding car and can only say poop poop until he acquires his own roadster. My own moment was on the seafront road between Folkestone and Hythe when I spotted a vision in metallic blue, chrome and glass, a low, sleek, two-seater, fixed-roof sports car. I discovered it was a Volvo 1800 ES, and it was another 25 years or so before I was to acquire a 1973 ES one of my own. It still looked fantastic, but it was a bit of a pig to drive, but more of that story later. Going Italian, a Fiat 127. My next car was to be more modern, which wasn't too difficult, as the Austin had dated from 1958, and the Triumph was already 6 or 7 years old when I bought it. But this was a common pattern of car ownership amongst people of my age at the time. The new car, a mere 2 years old, was a further stride into later 20th century technology. Quite what modern advances this new limousine possessed, I'm struggling to remember, but coming clean, it was a Fiat 127 hatchback, improbably described as an early super mini. Again, it had two doors, but with a hatchback and a flat folding rear seat. It possessed a 903cc engine, which was mounted transversely and described in Wikipedia as state-of-the-art at that time. It felt quite sporty, but I think this was an impression gained from its exhaust note that I would think was based on a Vespa scooter. My research reveals it won the European Car of the Year award and sold over 1 million units within 3 years of its launch. Compared to the A35, Triumph Herald and even the Mini, the Fiat at least looked like it might have been tried in a wind tunnel before the design was finalised. Trying to remember any standout features has left me a little stumped. The hatchback and the fold flat seats were certainly useful, as I was involved in do-it-yourself and decorating our house, in common with most 20-somethings at that time, and flat-pack furniture was now available. The rear window had an electric demisting element, there were hazard warning lights, and I think there was a radio, but I might have put that in. Despite the relatively Spartan features, it proved reliable, so much so that I believe it's the car out of all those I've ever owned that was driven furthest from home. Travelling to the south of France and into Spain on some scary roads over the Pyrenees, this fact alone gives it some kudos. I recall that the journey required tinting the headlamps amber, installing a map reading light and a green sunscreen strip on the windscreen, as well as buying a folding warning triangle. It was my first experience of driving on the wrong side of the road, at least intentionally. Then the journey around Paris's peripheric ring road was quite memorable and a bit of a white knuckle ride. I also had an accident in this car, thankfully a minor one, skidding on ice in the office car park and incurring minor damage to a wing hitting a wall. Anyone who's experienced aquaplaning or skidding on ice will remember the experience as particularly unnerving, the silence, the lack of control, and the long seconds waiting for a possible impact. Not nice, and it made me very cautious of icy roads. Modern cars now often show a little snowflake warning in the instruments if the temperature is down to 4 degrees centigrade or below, and I welcome this as a good improvement. Triumph Spitfire. My next car was viewed by me as a further leap up the ladder of cool, despite it being an older car and an older design. It was a red sports car. Too young to have a midlife crisis and still possessing a full head of hair, I succumbed to the dubious pleasures, at least in the UK, of open-topped motoring. The car in question was a 1970 Mark III Triumph Spitfire, with a 1300cc engine complete with twin carburettors, whatever happened to them, and a fold-down hood. Bought from the original one owner, a family member by marriage, it was in good condition and had been well looked after. Although the published performance figures, 13 seconds 0-60 and a top speed of 95 miles per hour, are relatively pedestrian compared to modern cars, the combination of the wind in the hair, the noise, the low seating position near the ground gave it an enhanced sensation of speed. In this car, I experienced seeing my first 100 miles per hour on the speedometer. The car was also fitted with a radio and an 8-track tape stereo, and I'm sure the introduction of loud rock music into the car enhanced the driving style. The size of the 8-track cassettes, almost the same size as a VHS tape or a small paperback book to those readers mystified by the references to VHS tapes, and the limited storage space in the car meant the same tapes were played over and over again. I can only recall a Santana album, a Dylan one, Blood, Sweat and Tears, and a Them album featuring a young Van Morrison. I eventually replaced the 8-track with a radio cassette player that allowed playing a greater range of music through the 1970s popularity of home taping. People would loan their records to each other and copy them onto tape cassettes. I'm sure working musicians might have seen this as the start of the erosion of musicians' earnings that's ended up with iTunes and Spotify. The Spitfire shared some similarities with my previous Triumph Herald, including the folding out of the whole wings and bonnet, allowing easy engine access. As I said earlier, this was the era of home mechanics, out of enthusiasm or economy, or probably both. It was one of the last cars that I performed extensive maintenance on, with routine tasks such as cleaning carburettors, adjusting the ignition, replacing plugs and filters, as well as brake parts and exhausts. I believe that the Spitfire also required the occasional replacement of bushes and washers in the gear change, which I could now execute, if not blindfold, certainly very easily. I even fitted an electronic ignition unit that avoided the regular chore of adjusting the ignition points. Car home mechanics magazines were quite popular, and helpful work colleagues would tear out a relevant article for your car. Through this medium, I learned how to balance the twin carbs and set ignition timings. Improvements, although some of these were more dubious in their inherent advantages. One of these made me realise why it was fashionable for some cars to have small red cylindrical fire extinguishers in the car. I'd always thought these to be an affectation, but one had come with the car, clamped to the transmission tunnel in the passenger footwell. I had for some time worried about a fidgety passenger accidentally setting it off with their feet and filling the small interior with a mass of foam. In the event when I needed to use it, it took so long to undo the clips and the nozzle that the potential danger had subsided. It was all my own fault. The car, along with most of those of that era, wasn't equipped with rear fog lights. A helpful article in Maniac Mechanic or some such publication suggested the keen owner, with some small black box and some cable clips, could adapt the circuitry to the rear brake lights. These could then be partially brightened to an intermediate brightness between normal rear lights and full brake lights. I duly installed it with a new switch boasting a red warning bulb into a spare position on the dashboard. For some weeks, all was well, until one morning, driving up Reigate Hill, heading for the office in South London, I encountered thick fog. Rather smugly, I threw the switch, and all was well briefly, until I was aware that as well as the lack of visibility outside the car, it was accompanied by growing fogginess inside the car, which I soon realised was acrid-smelling smoke. Luckily, I pulled over, praying that nobody was going to rear-end me. I switched off the ignition and took out the fire extinguisher and prepared to tackle a conflagration. To my relief, it seemed that switching off the ignition had stopped the fire. Getting back in and looking for the source of the potential disaster, I soon found that my new improvement was the source, and the smoke was the melting of the insulation on the newly installed wires. Disconnecting this, I was relieved to find there was no further damage and the lights and brake lights still functioned. I returned the magazine cutting to my work colleague and suggested politely where he could put it. They say you learn by your mistakes, but I'm not sure this is always universally true, as some of us bravely and doggedly pursue the search for excellence and new life experiences. Probably in one of the mechanical magazines that I should now be studiously ignoring after the brake light fire, there were instructions for improving your windscreen washers. The improvements were to convert the normal boring cold water wash to a hot wash, infinitely more effective for the removal of road grime, salt and dead flies. The instructions were simple and to my mind ingenious. You were to insert in the section of hose from the reservoir to the windscreen jets an additional length of thin plastic hose, which you would wind around one of the top heater hoses, which contained hot water. Thereby, there would be a heat transfer to the washer system. Brilliant. Once installed, it worked well and was even effective in clearing icing up once the engine was warmed up. There was, so I was to discover one hot summer's day, when stuck in a traffic jam, a flaw in the scheme. In a convertible car, you're able, at least in the days before cars were more commonly equipped with air conditioning, to feel reasonably smug compared to those sweating inside metal box cars. So sitting in stationary traffic on a hot day somewhere near Westerham in Kent, after an earlier quick drive that must have warmed an already hot engine, myself and my passenger were rather surprised to be given a hot water shower. The windscreen washers had turned themselves on to release the build-up of hot water in the system, and they wouldn't stop until the water in the system cooled, which seemed to take ages. I think we quickly put up the hoods so we were hot too, and a little damp. Not long after I had the Spitfire, we acquired our first dog. My girlfriend phoned me at work and broached the subject tentatively. You know you have said you would like a dog one day, and we both have had family dogs when we were children. I replied in a non-committal fashion with a guarded, yes, why? Well, I've heard of one that's a really nice one and needs a home. It's not a puppy, it's a lurcher. At the time, this term meant nothing to me. I envisaged a dog with legs of different lengths, so it walked with a gait. Undeterred, I was told the dog would be brought to see us the following weekend by the owners who had rescued him and already had another large dog and a child and needed Pep, his name, to go to a good home. I envisaged a sort of small terrier and waited to see our actual potential Pep pet the following weekend with a calm air, having been assured we were under no real obligation. I was young and naive. The following Saturday morning, a large estate car drew up in front of the house, and the owner took out a huge wicker bed before letting an equally huge, long-legged dog bound out of the rear door. They must really pamper their dog. He travels with his own bed, and no wonder they have to rehome our little Pep if they have to feed that monster. Anyway, I pondered, where is little Pep? It was only when the owner walked down the path to our front door, carrying the huge wicker bed the size of a large cartwheel, that the truth of the situation gradually dawned on me. This huge creature was Pep. There was no small terrier-sized lurcher. Once the door was open, Pep marched in and sat down and eyed us up, or rather, he looked down on us in a superior fashion, as his eyeline was above ours when we were seated. So what breed is he actually? I nervously asked. He's an Irish Wolfhound Greyhound cross, and he's very friendly and intelligent. He loves children. He looks as if he could eat a couple of small ones for breakfast, I thought. Does he eat much? I asked. Eats anything. He has a good appetite. The truth of this we were to find out later, which I will relate shortly. He seemed at home and happy. A collar and lead and an improbably large metal feeding bowl with a large bag of dog meal were handed over, and the previous owners left after inviting us to phone if we had any more questions. We were the dog owners of one of the largest dogs I'd ever seen. Question one, would he fit in the back of the Spitfire? Don't worry, my car's a hatchback, he can travel in that. So I was thinking my treasured two-seater would be redundant unless we went everywhere in convoy. I was to worry unnecessarily, as Stan, we never liked Pep, and the dog quickly learnt his new name, as true to his description, he was very intelligent, adapted very quickly to life with us. He was able to fold himself up into the space behind the seats of the Spitfire. From this position, he would put his head between us and closely observe where we were going, only pausing to stick his wet nose in one of our ears. This alarmed us, but also more alarming was the sudden barking if he saw a dog, which with his hound's eyesight he would inevitably spot before we had. This lent a new sense of drama to our journeys. We also found that when travelling with the hood down, the wind would sometimes irritate his ears, so a sort of chew bobble hat was knitted for him, which he happily wore, not minding the hilarity it caused amongst some spectators in other cars or at the roadside. He had a regal air about him, and rightly thought he could carry off this unusual canine sartorial look. I mentioned earlier that Stan had a healthy appetite, and his previous owner said he ate anything. We were to have this confirmed some weeks later, when we had arranged a week away in Gower. In preparation, we were defrosting the fridge and packing, and we went out to do some last-minute shopping and filling the car up with petrol. We had given Stan a long run on the downs that morning, where he would tear up and down and swerve at the last minute in front of us. He had a speed approaching that of his half-greyhound ancestry, so we weren't surprised that he was fast asleep in his large basket when we went out. On our return, it was a different story. On our return, he appeared to have gone mad and greeted us at the door with a crazed expression, lips curled and slimy, showing large teeth and crouching with his tail between his legs. This was not his normal jolly greeting that the few short weeks of our acquaintance with him had led us to expect. Skirting around him, we found that his behaviour was apparently one of guilt, as the kitchen was a scene of devastation. By a process of elimination, we concluded that from the worktop and the open fridge, he consumed, amongst other things, 2 packets of defrosting vegetables, a large tub of butter spread, some eggs, and as a crowning glory, almost 3 pounds of Best Stilton, bought the previous weekend in Nottingham Market. That afternoon's journey down the M4 required frequent openings of the windows as he subjected the car to his cheesy breath and worse from the other end. By the time we reached Swansea in a friend's flat to stay the night, before we collected the keys to our holiday cottage, we had all but forgiven him, so we gave him his normal supper and a short walk in the park to air him, before leaving him to sleep while we went out for a quick curry supper, suggesting that it may not be wise for him to join us, even if they would let him in. On our return, we found his appetite hadn't been completely sated, as the large fruitcake, baked and brought for our friend, had been extracted from our luggage and consumed, along with a proportion of the kitchen foil it was wrapped in. Our new companion was certainly some dog. We may have been alerted to this kleptomania had we received at the outset his Kennel Club certificate, which showed his registered name to be Pep Vagabond. Very apt. Still, now to us he was Stan the man. The next discovery was a little more alarming, as despite his generally affable nature, he seemed to take exception to some dogs and would growl and bristle, and if challenged by them, using his speed and height, grab them by their necks and throw them upside down. This was very alarming and embarrassing, and the only consolation was that this treatment was reserved for male dogs of a size and strength worth bothering with. Alsatians were a particular target, as anything smaller than a Labrador he regarded as not worth bothering with. It also appeared that the former conflict was more like a judo bout, where once the opponent was upside down on the deck, Stan would withdraw, wagging his tail, leaving the other dog embarrassed and floored. When contacting the previous owners, they reluctantly admitted that this had been an occasional problem, but they'd hoped he'd grow out of it. Given that our vet, on giving Stan an early once-over, suggested he was at least 5 years old, this seemed unlikely. The most embarrassing incident was when we'd gone with a group of friends to a pub unknown to us outside Guildford and had settled down to a round of drinks with Stan asleep under our table after a long walk there. Unfortunately, the pub landlord owned a large German shepherd dog who casually emerged from behind the bar while the landlord had left to go to the cellar. Stan had not been completely asleep and, spotting this potentially adversary, leapt up, overturning our table full of drinks, then overturned the shocked resident dog before pursuing him behind the bar, where fortunately 2 of us were able to grab him and drag him back, not without some effort. The landlord, having locked his poor dog away, returned and offered to replace our drinks, as it was most out of character for his dog to attack another dog who was sleeping. We drank our drinks and rapidly left before anyone present was able to provide an alternative, a more truthful version of events. I don't think we ever went to that pub again, with or without Stan. Returning to the topic of motoring, I noticed that when looking for some old pictures of the car, I haven't been able to find a picture of Stan in his hat, although I have found one of him in the back of the car wearing a straw hat that I don't think was his. I noticed that his occupation of the internal luggage space of the car had forced me to get a boot rack for going away, and I'd forgotten about this. I wasn't to realise this canine acquisition was the first of many compromises that would further influence our choice of cars for some years as we became serial dog owners.